You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world. And now, innovation thought leader and your super fly host, Tamara Kleinberg.
Hey everyone, I am so excited for today. We have Joe Carlin. He is the founder of Value Guards LLC and a practitioner of business valuation, patent valuation, and market assessment. He has consulted for a wide variety of entrepreneurs and companies over the past 15 years, including Westinghouse and Unicom Technology. He has a Master's of Information Systems Management from Carnegie Mellon, is a certified valuation analyst, and has an MBA from the University of Pittsburgh. In 2008, he was asked to co-author From Lifeguard to Sun King, the best-selling biography of Banana Boat founder Robert Bell. Subsequently, he wrote The Einstein of Money, a comprehensive biography of Warren Buffett's mentor, Benjamin Graham, for which he had the privilege of interviewing. His newest book, A Brief History of Entrepreneurship, The Pioneers, Profiteers, and Racketeers Who Shaped Our World, was published by Columbia University Press in late 2016. I'm so excited to have you here, and I just have to say, as I was saying a little bit offline, I have a heart, you know, place in my heart for Banana Boat, so maybe we can dig into that, but I am happy to have you here today.
Thanks. I'm glad to be on.
So I just want to start with, because I think entrepreneurship is one of those words that gets thrown around a lot. What is your definition of entrepreneurship?
Well, my favorite definition of entrepreneurship is Peter Drucker's. And his definition was the act of endowing resources with a new capacity to create wealth. Because I think that his definition applies to a wide range of innovative economic activity. So it's not only innovation in the Steve Jobs sense, but innovation in terms of historically creating a new trade route or a more efficient way of stocking goods or whatever it might be. So I think that it's still not 100% airtight definition, but I think that's the best definition that I've come across, because the word itself stems from a French word meaning one who undertakes something, which of course is extremely vague. And the before English speakers started using that word, the term people use for what we now call entrepreneurs was adventurer. And in a way, I think the word adventurer is more evocative and more precise than the word entrepreneur. But in terms of the definitions that I've seen, I prefer Drucker's.
And I just want to dig in a little bit to that, because I think it's so important, especially because, you know, I think in the media today, we look at entrepreneurs as the Steve Jobs, Elon Musks, you know, those types who are incredible entrepreneurs. But I think what I hear you saying in Drucker's definition and how you're saying it, it's not just I've, you know, completely disrupted a category and brought a new product or service to market. It's how you do things differently and create new opportunities. Is that fair to say?
Definitely, because the concept of entrepreneur that we have now, sort of the inventor entrepreneur or the inventorpreneur, as I once heard a patent attorney describe it, that is relatively new. That kind of entrepreneur really became a noticeable category with the British Industrial Revolution. Before that, this kind of scientific experimentation and improvements was sort of in a separate container to making money. And then really those two roles kind of came together in the British Industrial Revolution with people like James Watt and these people who patented their improvements to the steam engine or to coal or whatever it might have been. And then they commercialized that, and it, in some cases, became extraordinarily wealthy. So that's sort of more in the Steve Jobs, Bill Gates mold of Elon Musk, certainly, of that kind of entrepreneur is actually just a few hundred years old. So that's why I think that the and also today, most entrepreneurs today, even today, are not, like you say, disrupting entire categories. They might just be doing slight improvements here and there, and they're able to exploit that to make a profit.
It's so interesting because, I think when I look at the cover of, the magazines that I even love, Fast Company, Inc., it's always that, crazy inventor in the garage, up all night on their own doing something incredible. But it really is such a broader thing about how you view the world and how you tackle opportunities. I shared a little bit about your background in the beginning. Tell us a little bit more on how that ties in with entrepreneurship.
Sure. So most of my career I've spent working with entrepreneurs in terms of providing them with fundraising documents, valuations of their businesses, their patents, market assessments, mostly for entrepreneurs, also for some more established companies, but mostly for entrepreneurs in the sense of startup entrepreneurs or people running middle market companies. So having essentially my clients have been entrepreneurs, and I've been exposed to all kinds of industries and products and services of varying levels of innovation and uniqueness. So I'm often thinking about entrepreneurial challenges and helping entrepreneurs address them. So even though I may not be an entrepreneur myself in the strictest sense, I've had a lot of entrepreneurial experience from working with many hundreds of entrepreneurs at this point.
It's so cool that you get to see, for lack of a better way to say, a broad stroke of entrepreneurship with all these different types. If you were to pull out one thing to say, this is the pattern, the theme that I see across all of them, what would that be? Because I think that's a very unique perspective to come from.
Well, I think the common thread is having a really envisioning something that to one extent or another does not exist yet, and having the faith that and the focus to realize that, to make something that does not exist to bring it to the market. And so there's a certain degree of tenacity and confidence and planning that's required, certainly for the more successful ones.
I love what you said about faith and focus, because it really is half the battle is having the idea. But I talk a lot about, and I'm on board with what you're saying, that the other half is pursuing it, which is that faith and focus to get it done. And doesn't that sometimes seem like, I don't know if in your research you found this, the hard part too? I mean, a lot of people have ideas, but it's the ones that actually pursue it that make the difference.
Yes, that is probably, there are some tremendous examples of very wildly successful entrepreneurs who actually innovated very little, but what they did innovate and what they did conceive of, they just executed on it so well, and they marketed it so aggressively that they outperformed, at least financially outperformed, much more innovative competitors. There's many examples like that.
And then, does the Pet Rock fit into that? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I am familiar with that. The 60s, the Pet Rock. Yeah, that's a great example. I mean, that's something that is sort of almost silly in a way, but it was marketed so aggressively that it, I do think that over time the quality of an idea is important, and I think the reason why people are still playing Monopoly 80, 90 years after it was invented is because there was some real thought and inventiveness put into it. But whereas something like the Pet Rock is more of a fad, but there's been games and all kinds of things that are just as interesting and just as innovative as Monopoly that no one has heard of because it was never promoted effectively.
Right, the execution fell short for whatever reason. So you've done all this research. You were surprised by how impactful entrepreneurship has been over the course of human history. We talk a little bit about that because I think, things that we take for granted today, someone invented.
Right. Well, I think that the impact of going back to the pre-entrepreneur word of these adventurers or the economic adventurers and people doing new things, exploring new territories in the pursuit of profit, often the impact of what they were doing had all kinds of unanticipated consequences, some negative, some positive, that reached far beyond their own economic situation. And sometimes the impact was even beyond economics and changed society in ways that no one could have expected. So that's why I believe that entrepreneurship is one of the prime movers of history. And I think that certainly now it's happening with space tourism. That's probably one of the most impactful examples ever, because the government's been pulling out of the space program, and here you have this whole space tourism industry coming up that is largely funded by people like Musk and Richard Branson and the like. And space tourism already exists. Over about 15 years ago, someone was charged $20 million to go. I mean, somebody paid $20 million to go in orbit for 8 hours. So this is something that already exists and is moving ahead, so that a much larger range of people will be able to explore space. And that's an entrepreneurial project.
You know, what's interesting about that story too, as you're sharing it, I was thinking, wow, on one hand, you could look at that and you could say, how disappointing, our government, NASA, you know, whoever is pulling out, doesn't have the resources, it's not a priority. Yet that vacuum, no pun intended, that vacuum actually opened up the opportunity for other entrepreneurs to come in and take a go at it.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, that's certainly, I think, a net positive example of the impact of entrepreneurship. But of course, the book is certainly not cheerleading entrepreneurship. There are plenty of examples of nefarious forms of entrepreneurship and the negative impact. But certainly, space tourism is an example where I think it's a great thing that these sort of mega entrepreneurs are coming in and putting so many resources into this.
I love mega entrepreneurs. I'd like to be one of those one day. What are some, you know, I don't think I ever kind of really give thought to the negative consequences that happen out of entrepreneurship. I'm always focused on the positive changes or the shift in marketplace. Will you give one or two examples of that side of the coin?
Sure. So I think that slavery, and not only the kind of slavery we think of in terms of early colonial history, because there's examples of slavery in other civilizations going way, way back, as we all know. So that, but just slavery in general throughout world history was often undertaken by people who we call entrepreneurs, people who were establishing new trade routes and who usually traded other things besides slaves, but who made much of their profit through slavery. And it's certainly hard to find much of a silver lining in that. But that's an example. I think another example is what happened is the bootlegging.
Right.
And then once Prohibition was repealed, that whole network soon turned to the import of various substances, including heroin. So I think, I mean, and also there's all kinds of illicit arms dealing, and so there are forms of, but you know what's interesting is, for example, there's a bit of a profile on Capone in the book, and even though he was a bad guy, he was a very talented entrepreneur, and say as was Victor Butt, who was. They called him the sanctions buster, someone who sold weapons, Russian weapons, to all kinds of both sides of different civil wars all over the world and whatnot after the Soviet Union fell. And these are people who were very talented entrepreneurs in terms of setting up distribution, in terms of doing all the business fundamentals, actually. but they were doing it with something totally nefarious. But they still were talented entrepreneurs in their own way.
God, it's so interesting. I really hadn't thought about that side of it, but you're absolutely right. And I've been watching these documentaries on kind of drugs in America, and it's been fascinating to see some of the real, for lack of a better way to say it, leaders in those industries who are quite innovative in how they did things. Yeah. And I thought, God, that's right. They're entrepreneurs. They're just have a little bit of a different bent than the ones that we like to idolize and think about. You know, you've researched a ton of this and interacted with a lot of entrepreneurs. Do you think that the entrepreneurial skill is something that you're born with or something that you acquire? And I'm asking just, you know, to give you some context for a couple reasons. One is this ongoing debate that we constantly hear, and it seems like some people are really gravitate towards it and some don't. The flip side is, you know, we need more entrepreneurship in this country, and I often wonder if given the right tools, can you head in that direction?
I think there's a lot of nuance in that issue. I think the short answer is probably yes, that people can be sort of groomed for entrepreneurship to an extent. I also think that there seems to be a disproportionate number of entrepreneurs who grow up in facing some kind of challenges in their youth. A classic example would be Warren Buffett's father being temporarily getting wiped out, and that left an impression on Buffett when he was very young that he needed to make a lot of money. And Andrew Carnegie, similar sort of grew up in poverty, and or it's a case of sort of an immigrant trying to prove himself in some way. There's usually some sort of chip on the shoulder, so to speak, that provides the motivation. So I think that somebody might be born with all the faculties in terms of intelligence and this and that, but might not, for the way that person was raised, might not necessarily have as much motivation as the next guy person who might not be as naturally gifted, but who just has more of the inclination, more of the motivation.
So there's like an igniter that comes along in their lifetime that helps push them in that direction.
I think that's a big part of it for many of them.
Oh, that's interesting. So I want to dig a little bit into the book. The subtitle is The Pioneers, Profiteers, and Racketeers Who Shaped Our World. I love that, how you include it. And I just have to ask, before I ask about the characters in the book, why pioneers, profiteers, and racketeers?
Well, I think that, first of all, I think pioneers is important because many people don't think of for example, the people who colonized the Americas and Africa and many other parts of the world. Many people don't think of them as entrepreneurs, but they were. And in most cases, they were actually backed not by governments, but by private merchant companies. Mm. So that was really much more of an entrepreneurial project than I think we often realize. And profiteers and racketeers, this whole idea of people who were just focusing on profits, and then their impact and then what they did had consequences well beyond their personal economic situation. And racketeers, just as a reminder that not all these people in this book are heroes necessarily.
Right, as we just talked about, like with Al Capone, for example.
Yeah.
What are some of the most, are there any of the, I know we talked a lot about a lot of different characters. Is there any kind of story or one entrepreneur in particular from your book that really stays with you, stays in your mind?
Well, one of my favorites would be a lady by the name of Funke Opeki. And she's a Nigerian who immigrated to the States, and she actually became an executive at Verizon for a while. And then she had a background in engineering, And she decides she wanted to go back to Nigeria and improve things there. So anyway, make a long story short, she goes back and she works for Nitel. And she's very frustrated with the infrastructure in Nigeria. So she resigns from Nitel, which was the Nigerian telecom company. It doesn't exist anymore. But anyway, she resigns from there and she sets up her own company called Main One. And she raises over $200 million to set up a fiber optic link, underwater fiber optic between Europe and West Africa. And then that company is selling broadband. And now much of West Africa, because of her and her company, has access to broadband. And there's all kinds of new startups and whatnot. So I think that's a really... It's a great example for a number of reasons. One, because she started this company relatively late in life. And two, because it's amazing that she was able to raise all that money like that. And three, it shows sort of the future of entrepreneurship in the how important it can be in a very positive sense in the developing world.
That's a wonderful example of what we were talking about earlier about the impact it makes on the world. And I love what you said about it. She started later in life, because I think that's a great lesson for those out listening, that you don't have to be the, you know, skinny jeans, man bun millennial,
right,
to start to be an entrepreneur. And I think there's a lot of conflict around that, or a lot of myth around that, that, you know, if you've passed a certain age, you're done. And clearly that is not true. And that impact there is absolutely, absolutely tremendous. I want to hear your perspective on, you know, the tale of two dropouts. It's Bill Gates versus Steve Jobs. I think we hold them on similar pedestals, yet they're so different. I'd love to hear your perspective about those two.
Yeah, I think that they're very, I mean, the reason why that section is called Tale of Two Dropouts is because they obviously have both of them had a very independent spirit, and it takes a lot of a certain amount of confidence, really extreme self-confidence to walk away from a university degree,
yeah,
and pursue your entrepreneurial dream, which actually Elon Musk also did that, but they also were, it was almost inevitable that they would butt heads at some point, which also is addressed there. But I mean, I think both of them are, I think Steve Jobs was more of the, a little bit more of the inventor entrepreneur, whereas Bill Gates was more of the person who said, okay, here's the product. Now we're just going to blast the market and make sure that everyone is going to use this product. And Steve Jobs had some of that, but I think Jobs was a little bit more on the product innovation side. And I think it's reflected in their careers, in that Steve Jobs, even though Bill Gates was much wealthier, Steve Jobs ended up having success in a much wider range of industries: animation, music, telecommunications, and this and that, as well as PCs. So they're very different people and different types of entrepreneurs. And I think there's a lot to learn from both of them.
So I got a couple questions here swimming, but one is, you know, a lot of the people in our community are what we call intrapreneurs, right? You know, innovative, ownership invested minded people, but inside teams, and as well as entrepreneurs trying to launch things. And, you know, I know what circles in their head sometimes, and I totally get it because I'm one of those people, is, well, I'm not Bill Gates, I'm not Steve Jobs, I'm never going to be Al Capone, right? I'm not those icons of entrepreneurship. But you can learn a lot from all of that. So what is your advice for, you know, the rest of us entrepreneurs out there who, you know, we're doing something amazing, something breakthrough, but we're not those guys?
Well, I think that, you know, in terms of what can be learned from those guys and how it applies.
Sure.
Well, I think that these learning about these different entrepreneurs historically, I think there are many lessons for all kinds of entrepreneurs. In terms of Gates and Jobs, it shows that someone who is in different, you don't necessarily need to focus just on one industry, and you can have success in multiple industries like Jobs did. But more applicable to most of us is, for example, in a chapter about the entrepreneurs of the Industrial Revolution, the British Industrial Revolution. We see an example of an entrepreneur who probably didn't even invent what he claimed to invent, but it marketed it so aggressively and was first to market, and he made a lot more money than another entrepreneur who definitely did invent what he purported to invent, but did not patent it and suffer the consequences for that. So yeah, that's
It goes back to what you were saying about faith and focus and seeing things through and taking the steps and a little bit, you know, like you can have the best idea, but if it's half-assed in execution.
Right.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, if it's not executed well, or if it's a invention-based concept that you haven't bothered to protect, then, you know, there are consequences for that. So that's certainly something that applies to, you know, there are many part-time inventors and people who are entrepreneurs in an innovative sense.
So I have to ask about the banana boat, and I'm not even sure what to ask, but I'll just share a little story with you, because when I read that when I was prepping for this interview, I just lit up because I love banana boats. Love them. And it, you know, it stems from every year as a kid, we would go to Mexico at different places and on vacation. And the thing that I always, and my sister too, she would say it, that we always looked forward to was the banana boat ride. Like, we loved it. And we have such fond memories and such funny photos of us as kids on those silly banana boats with, you know, 10 other kids on them being pulled by a boat in the bay somewhere. And then as an adult, I've got a friend who's got a condo on a beach in Mexico, and we went and we stayed with them, and we're sitting on the beach and a banana boat goes by, and he turns to me and he says, and we're in our 40s now, and he says, you know, I always wanted to ride that as a kid, but I never did. And I was always so sad. And he used to watch the banana boat go back and forth. And then, so we as adults rode it, of course, because I wasn't going to let that opportunity pass by, and which was awkward and funny in itself. But it really has a heart space for a lot of people. So you just, I don't even know what to ask you. I just want to dig a little bit into the banana boat and kind of what you learned from writing that book.
Okay. But I should clarify. So this is the Banana Boat Sun Care Company.
But I thought banana boat.
No, but it is inspired by that, because Robert Bell grew up in Miami, and he was inspired by the Caribbean banana boat, which is probably something, I don't know the origin of the boat itself, but it's probably something that goes back a while. But he was inspired by that, and obviously it turned out to be a great branding for his sun care cream, because he built it up to the number two sun care brand in the world after Coppertone.
That's amazing. I have to say, I buy their products. It's so funny, because I really went on the path in my head the minute I saw Banana Boat. I went in my head to all my childhood memories, but maybe that's why I buy the sun care products too. And I just didn't even know it.
That was a huge differentiator for him was the branding. And what he did is a great example of someone with he didn't have much money, and he at that time in the late 70s, all the formulas were quite greasy.
Yeah.
And he figured out a way of doing a non-greasy formula, and he built it up from his garage into something that was quite significant.
There's so many lessons in both the story that you're sharing and my confusion with it just now, but I just have to go through those a little, and I love your perspective on it. One is, it just goes to show you that, you know, brands and products and things really do carry emotional space with people, and you can really tap and leverage that as an entrepreneur. I mean, he had the same inspiration that I had for the memories. He turned it into a, you know, very successful sun care company. I just continue with my memories and ride them as an adult because it's fun. But it kind of stemmed from the same place, which is super fascinating. And this idea, which I think what you're saying is, he took everything else that was out there on the marketplace and said, well, how can I do this differently?
Exactly. And then he kept doing that. He was the first one to do the high SPF and the aloe vera, aloe gel. That was his idea. So he kept innovating during the 11 or 12 years that he built up the company until he sold it.
That's fascinating. Okay, I'm going to move on from banana boat, but I just the whole thing makes me happy. So, and I can smell it as we talk. So it's just the whole thing makes me happy. You know, as we kind of alluded to earlier, there are a lot of everyday entrepreneurs that we never hear of. What do you think makes them tick and keep going? Because I think sometimes, you know, we look at those guys and we're like, oh, they have such a need for ego, the big guys that we hear about. But I don't know that that's true for everybody. What do you think makes entrepreneurs tick?
Well, I think 99% of entrepreneurs, I think at least two thirds or so, they're not looking to become the next Oprah Winfrey or Elon Musk or what have you. I think people, they're independent people who like to earn a living themselves without having a boss. I think that's a big part of it. Although there certainly are many people who fit that bill who are not necessarily entrepreneurs, right? Like someone who's an accountant,
yeah,
in a sense. And so, but so it's a bit of a gray area. But I think that's a big part of it. And I think that in many cases, there are people who have motivations that have very little to do with money. There are people who really have altruistic motivations related to the health or the environment or whatnot, who are pursuing their passion in that way. Of course, they don't want to go broke. They do want to make money from it. But I've certainly met quite a few entrepreneurs like that who are motivated by an idea that'll have some kind of social impact. So I think it varies, but I don't think that most entrepreneurs are starry-eyed, at least the ones that I've
You know, and it makes me, well, I'm in Colorado where we're a hub of entrepreneurship right now and a lot of actually social entrepreneurship and nonprofit. And as you were talking about that, it made me realize that a lot of the people that I know who are starting nonprofits, we see them as just do-gooders, but really they're entrepreneurs with some kind of social mission at the end of the day. And they're doing it in that way, as well as the ones that we think of, you know, inventing a new product, starting a new business. It's all kind of wrapped into the same thing.
Yeah, and there's certainly I think there's, I mean, with Elon Musk, there's much of his motivation is on that sort of the public. A lot of what he does is he sees it like, what's the public good here, and
yeah.
A lot of with Tesla and whatnot. So I think even some of those iconic entrepreneurs have some of those motivations, especially once they've attained financial security for themselves and they look for a broader meaning for what they're doing.
Yeah, more of what's my legacy now, which is a very different conversation.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a litmus test for entrepreneurship? So if you're listening to this and you're going, God, I might be one. Is there a way to know?
Well, I think probably the quickest litmus test is to ask oneself how comfortable one is with uncertainty.
Yeah.
And a certain level of instability. And I think that people who freak out at any kind of uncertainty probably should stay away from entrepreneurship.
Do you think that I want to dig a little bit on that for a second, because you know what I work with a lot of startups and the entrepreneurs, but I also work with a lot of Fortune 500, and I'm hearing a lot of uncertainty in their world as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just trying to put those two together in my head of, wow, yes, I mean, I'm an entrepreneur. I own my own business. I have been for many years. Totally get it. Uncertainty is part of it, especially when you're carving new paths. There's no one there to say, this is how you should do it. Mm-hmm. So you've got to figure it out as you go. I think a lot of people in the corporate world are starting to feel that sense of uncertainty in their worlds with a changing marketplace, changing customer, you know, just the customer having so much control over your brand and the business nowadays, as we've seen in the last couple of weeks. What would you say to them?
What would I say to them in terms of whether or not they should be entrepreneurs or?
Or just what lessons they can glean from it as well, because I think that they could probably take away some value in that mindset that I think entrepreneurs more naturally take on, because their world is starting to look a little more like ours. Yes, they get a paycheck every 2 weeks. Yes, but their job isn't as certain as it used to be.
Right. Yeah, I think that the taking on the attitude of, or sort of learning to be uncomfortable with with a certain level of discomfort, as paraphrase someone. I think that is something, yeah, and certainly things are changing more rapidly than ever in terms of technology, and like you're saying with they can't control the messaging as much with all the technology that the customer has and whatnot. So they have to become, like you're saying, they have to become more entrepreneurial, which means becoming more adaptable, really, which means having to spot changes as they happen and react quickly, but also react in the context of a plan. I mean, not just knee-jerk reaction. So it which is sort of like you're saying, the challenges that entrepreneurs have is to react quickly but not impulsively. And yeah, it's a very interesting point that even some of these large corporations are being forced to behave more like nimble entrepreneurs.
Yeah, I mean, it's I'm seeing a lot of it. It's oftentimes why I get brought in. It's, you know, it's innovation, but really, if you think about it, it's closely tied to thinking like an entrepreneur and acting like an entrepreneur. And I want to actually loop it back to a bigger question, because as you were talking, it got me thinking about how, you know, we talk a lot about change and, you know, the rate of change. And I would probably argue that change has always been here. If you ask my parents, who are, you know, late baby boomers, they would say they lived in a time of incredible change. And if you ask their parents, they'd probably say the same thing. So, you know, it seems like we're feeling it right now. So for us, it feels rapid and crazy and hard to manage, but it feels like change has always been here. But I wonder if you think for entrepreneurs in particular, given the more even playing field with technology, you know, we're able to start businesses, we're able to resource things, we're able to do distribution with the online. Is it easier to become an entrepreneur today than it was, or is it always, you know, relative to the time, been about the same?
I think logistically it's easier. It's easier to do business globally, and it's easier to have the infrastructure in place to sell things to almost anyone. That said, because it's easier, it's also more competitive because the entry barriers are lower, so there are, you know, 7-odd billion people in the world who most of which have access to the same technologies we do.
Yeah, I love what you're saying there. I think it's so important for us to keep in mind. In fact, I was just thinking of an aspiring entrepreneur I met the other day after a keynote, and he said, you know, we've got this new technology, this new app, and, you know, I won't share any more than that because he hasn't done anything with it yet, but he said, you know, we don't have any competition. We're the only ones doing this. And I thought, whoa, buddy, slow your roll. I guarantee you have competition. You just don't know about it yet because so many of us can get into the marketplace now. It's a really cool and challenging thing all at the same time.
Yeah. And I think I think overall there's probably more opportunity in the last chapter of the book, which talks about the sort of the more globalized entrepreneurial world. There are some interesting examples of companies in the first world, in the United States and Canada and so forth, who are now earn most of their revenue from clients in the what was once called the third world.
Right.
So.
Right. It's this global economy. So with all this great information and your books, how should people connect with you and buy your books online?
So the main website is value-guards.com, and there's a link there to the about the book. And yeah, value-guards.com.
Got it. And we'll put the link in the show notes too, so people can easily get to it. All right, Joe, to end our insightful time together, what's the one thing people would be totally surprised to learn about you?
I really like playing blues piano.
No, I would not have guessed that. I'm always so surprised what I learn about people on these shows. How did you get into that?
My brother started playing guitar, and there was a piano in the living room, so I tried to learn some chords from him and went from there.
Wow, because you just never know. Well, Joe, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure and extremely insightful digging into entrepreneurship with you.
Thank you.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.